The conference is now being recorded.
Welcome to the first teleconference Investor Update and Manager Q&A of the Global Value Fund. And now I'd like to hand over to the Fund Manager and Director, Miles Straught. Please go ahead, Miles.
Thanks, Tammy. Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning for those that have gotten up early in London. Thank you for making some time today to dial into this investment update presentation for the Global Value Fund. I'm really sorry I can't be in Australia at this time hosting the roadshows that I normally do. As you all know, my wife and I just had our first child, and it just wasn't possible for me to take the month or so off that the roadshow generally entails. However, I hope this call today provides us with a similar opportunity to provide an update on the company, and most importantly, an opportunity to answer any questions that shareholders might have. We have prepared a presentation pack, which you all hopefully have received a copy of by now. And if you're on the call today and you don't have a copy, if you send a quick email to ir@globalvaluefund.com.au, our head of investor relations has gotten up nice and early with me here in London, and we'll email you a copy just now. As this is a call, I'll let you know what slide I'm referring to as we go through it. And what I'll do is I'll be referring to the number in the bottom right-hand side of the page on your document. Also, as this is a call and not so interactive, I wanted to aim to keep my presentation to about 15 minutes or so, which I think is a long time to be sitting on the phone listening to someone speak. And after this, I'll open the call up to questions. And we've also had quite a few questions emailed in, so I'll address those as well too. So in the presentation pack you have, I'll be talking to sections 2, 3, and 4. We will also be producing a video here in London in the coming weeks, which we'll email out to all shareholders. And in that, the team and I are going to dig into the presentation in a bit more detail in a bit more of an interactive way. But today, what I mainly wanted to cover off was just to provide an update on the investment portfolio and then to open the call up to questions. And just before I start, and maybe I'll touch on this at the end, you know, after the call, it'd be really helpful to receive any comments or feedback that you might have. In this day and age of technology, there's lots of different ways we can stay in touch and make ourselves available. And to be honest, some of the best suggestions we've had in terms of shareholder communications, which we've shamelessly adopted as our own, have been ideas that have been emailed into us from our shareholders. So if there's anything you want to say at the end, good or bad, please don't be shy. Now, if I could start you all off on slide number 6. I'm sure this slide is familiar to many of you on the call, but I always like to provide a quick introduction into who we are and what we do, as we do get new shareholders joining us all the time and potential new shareholders joining these presentations as we go through time. So by way of a very quick introduction, we are a bit different to most of the funds you will have come across before. The core skill set of the team and I is really an ability to unlock value from discounted assets. Instead of trying to outperform the market by picking stocks and bonds, we look for ways we can invest into the market at a discount, you know, ways we can buy dollars worth of assets for less than a dollar. And then through a number of tools that we have, we seek to unlock this value for our clients. By employing our strategy, we're aiming to offer our investors two sources of return: the underlying returns that come from the assets that we own, and then the extra return that comes from unlocking the discounts and the investments we've made. We have a big number of tools in our toolbox which we use to unlock value. Some of these revolve around trading techniques that we employ. Others rely on shareholder activism, which is something that we always use very sparingly, but when we need to, something that we do use, you know, we do use force. Our investors have trusted us with a very flexible mandate, one which is asset class agnostic, and this mandate lets the team and I hunt around the world, cherry-picking the most compelling risk-adjusted opportunities that we can find. Our stated goal is to generate equity market-like returns, but with a significantly lower risk profile, which is quite a challenging goal to set for yourself. But to date, we have outperformed global equity markets since the fund's launch and have done so with a meaningfully lower risk profile. If you turn now to slide 7, this slide shows our investment strategy at work. So it's the portfolio's gross returns since IPO. And what we've done is attribute our total returns into three categories: market returns, and these are the returns that we've generated from holding the very diversified portfolio of assets that we do. Currency returns, we've got global investors, and this shows the impact of currency movements on the investment portfolio over time. And lastly, you know, most importantly, you can see the excess return. This shows the alpha, or the extra return, that we've generated for our investors over and above market returns through the use of our investment process. And if you could turn to slide 8 now. So you'll see here a chart that should be new to all of you. One of the most important features of what we're aiming to do is to run a portfolio with a significantly lower risk profile than an investment in global equity markets. I've talked in the past about some of the ways we lower our risk profile. For example, you know, we invest into a much broader range of underlying asset classes than just shares, which means that we benefit from owning lower risk assets like bonds, and we also benefit from asset class diversification. In terms of the investment strategy itself, however, one of the inherently attractive features of what we do is that we benefit from an inbuilt safety margin that comes from investing into discounted assets. Even if markets are moved against us and the underlying value of what we've bought is to fall, if we're successful in unlocking value, and that's really our core skill set, unlocking value from discounted assets, then the discounts on what we've bought provide a meaningful safety margin. We can still make money, or things are particularly grim, lose less than what the market has lost, by successfully unlocking the value from what we've bought. What this chart shows here is the gross Australian dollar profit or loss of every single investment the fund has made since its IPO. We've shown the chart in actual dollar terms instead of percentage terms, as the fund has more than doubled in size since its IPO, which means it's very difficult to turn your raw dollar return numbers into a meaningful percentage number. Your denominator keeps changing through time and makes it very hard to turn it into a percentage figure. Regardless, what I think this chart shows really well is the inbuilt safety margin that I'm talking about. When investments work for us, as you can see on the far left-hand side of the page, they have the ability to work very well. When they don't work for us, it hasn't led to meaningful losses for the fund. And that a function of that is this inbuilt safety margin that I'm talking about. If we as a team are able to unlock value successfully, which we've done very well to date, then there's this great positive skew to the risk-reward profile of what we do. I think this chart shows that quite well. Moving on to slide 9. This shows our net returns against our reference index since IPO. At the time of the IPO, I guided our investors to expect us to have a beta or a risk profile of about half of that of a general investment in global share markets. And the reference index we publish here shows the theoretical return from the portfolio that was half invested into global share markets and half invested into Australian dollar cash interest rates. Below that is another new chart, and that shows the monthly alpha, or the excess return, we've generated since IPO in 2014, and hopefully it shows a nice consistency to what we do. Now, moving on to slide 10, or really slide 11, what I wanted to spend most of my time on today was to provide an update on the investment portfolio and talk about our year-to-date so far. And by year-to-date, I mean our financial year-to-date, so from June last year through to month end of April. As someone that spends his life with half an eye glued to a market screen, sadly, it's been a fascinating period of financial market history. In many ways, it feels like we've had two very different chapters over the year. We've had before Trump and after Trump. Before November 8th last year, when everyone was stunned by a surprise US presidential election result, we were 7 years into a bull market that was increasingly looking like it was running out of puff. Global share markets had basically gone sideways for 2 years, and the only share market to put on positive returns was the US share market. The S&P had put on double-digit returns over 2 years and really ground them out, but it had suffered two double-digit corrections along the way, and with both of those corrections being larger than anything we've seen since 2011. So not surprisingly, there are a lot of people in the market, including myself, that they thought the bull market was maybe on its last legs. Well, the great thing about financial markets is they never fail to surprise. And since the election of Trump, share markets have been given a tremendous new lease of life. The US share market has put on more in the past 6 months than it has done in the previous 2 years. And global share markets in total are about 15% higher. It's been a move that's surprised a lot of people, but least of all myself. As I was explaining earlier, though, in terms of our investment strategy, the key thing I want to impart on everyone is we do not invest in the share market. We own a very diversified portfolio of assets from which we are seeking to unlock value. We think it's a great approach and still provides really good returns, but which has a much greater protection built into it on the downside. I say all this as a precursor to explaining that we're having one of our best ever years in terms of the successful application of our investment process. But the returns you will have seen us generating really have had little to do with what you've seen happening in the share market. Year to date, we've generated more alpha and more excess return, the thing that we're most focused on. We generated more this year than we had done in the previous 2 years of GDS Life combined. And we'd had two good years before this year. So we're having a tremendous year. On slide number 7, you can see on the bottom chart here, so the bottom slide here is our monthly alpha generated. So that's the excess return we've generated each month this financial year. You can see that we've generated positive returns every month so far this year. And, you know, this is not meant to sound hubristic, and I'm well aware I'm tempting fate by saying this, but it is very unusual to get this far into a year without having a single down month. Year-to-date net return has been 13.5%, and we've generated that with an average see-through equity market exposure of just 26%. So it's certainly not been the case that we've just been long share markets in a year that they've all rallied. If you turn to slide 12 now, we've broken our attribution out into three categories. Our currency exposures have cost us some performance over the year, while our underlying market exposures have certainly helped, and part of that market exposure will certainly be the share market rally, but we had a very diversified basket of underlying assets, bonds, real estate, and other assets. So, you know, part of it's been the share market rally, but by no part all of it. But, you know, you can see the biggest contributor to our returns, by far the most dominating factor, has been the 13% we've generated from discount capture, 13% of alpha, 30% of market outperformance. In terms of where our returns have come from, there has been one big factor that we've exploited very successfully this year, and that was taking advantage of the opportunity set that came up in the weeks following Brexit, you know, the surprise UK vote to leave the European Union. In the month or so following this vote, which was a real market shock, there was an extraordinary range of really cheap opportunities out there for us to find. One of the key advantages I think we have is that, you know, relatively speaking, we are a smaller fund. We pride ourselves on being very, very light on our feet, and we're able to reposition the portfolio substantially during this market dislocation in a very short period of time. Very quickly, we turn the portfolio over and focus it on this tremendous opportunity set. Of the 13% of alpha you can see there that we've generated so far this year, about a third, so 30-odd percent, has come from opportunities that we found in the aftermath of Brexit and have subsequently harvested over this year. I should say that we're now largely out of all of our Brexit trade. So that one-off opportunity that we've exploited very well has come and gone. But the other two-thirds of the alpha that we've generated, which is still a sizable amount of outperformance, and the other two-thirds of the alpha has come from our bread and butter businesses. So finding discounted situations with a catalyst in place or a catalyst that we believe we could create to unlock value. And on the trading side, having our elbows out, taking advantage of the trading opportunities that we always find through time. I'll flick you over to slide 13. I've put this slide in to show how we opportunistically move between asset classes over time. You can see that our see-through equity market exposures averaged about 26% this year. That's ranged from 15% at a low all the way up to 35% at the high. So we've moved it around as we've found exciting opportunities. My view on markets is that I don't believe many people can really plausibly call them, and instead what we focus on is finding discounted ways to get into the market and situations where we think the discount is more attractive than the underlying market exposure. And I've got a really interesting example to talk about there. So if you have a look at this slide, along with the various asset classes that we invest into, you'll notice at the top a very consistent weighting to cash. That's the very top line that's increased, which has increased a little bit lately. And what I wanted to highlight was this is generally not are sitting on cash in the portfolio, but rather this shows the see-through exposure to cash as an asset class that was bought into at a discount, just like all of the other asset classes. You can see that they were bought into at exciting discounts. Now, it's a bit hard, you know, you've got to work very hard to find opportunities to buy cash at a discount, and in an environment where share markets are rallying strongly, you know, buying cash below face value is never going to sound as sexy as owning shares in another NASDAQ company. But, you know, there really isn't a better risk-adjusted opportunity out there than finding an investment in cash with a catalyst in place to unlock the value than other sorts of risk environments, risk assets in the market. These sorts of investments certainly don't keep up with the share market in a bull market environment, but I sleep a lot better at night knowing that we have them in the portfolio. just on that risk theme, if you turn now to slide 15, and this is the last slide I will talk to today. As I said earlier, we aim to run a portfolio with significantly less risk than a portfolio of equities. And there's lots of different ways to think about risk and ways to measure risk, but the top chart I have here I think is the simplest. It shows every down month that global share markets have had since GVF's IPO. And beside that, I put in a corresponding return that the GVF portfolio has delivered in the same month. Now, you need to measure risk and think about risk over a long period of time to draw sensible conclusions. And there's certainly months here where we've done worse, as well as better than my guidance of a beta of half to global equity markets. But on the whole, I think it's true to say we have exhibited about half of the risk of an investment in the share market. And importantly, despite this much lower risk profile, we have generated greater than equity market returns since IPO. The bottom chart here shows our Sharpe ratio. A Sharpe ratio shows you how many units of risk you took to generate the returns you did. It's a great way of levelling the playing field between different investment managers. And in one metric, you compare both risk and return. And the higher the Sharpe ratio, the better the investment profile. Now, those were the slides I wanted to touch on today. You know, in summary, our strategy has generated a lot of outperformance this year, and we're very pleased with the results. I need to stress this hasn't been a function of share markets rallying. That has helped a little bit, but has been by no means the substantial part of what we've done. And as share markets, you know, as I should say, as share markets continue to rally on the back of a big talking, big promising, let's see if he delivers, president, we remain very focused on just generating the best risk-adjusted returns we can, aiming to have the portfolio in a position to be able to protect shareholder capital if we do have any downturn from here. I will leave the formal presentation there now and open the call up to questions. We've had a number of shareholders email us questions in, so what I thought I would do is ask our operator, Tammy, to run through with everyone the procedure for asking questions, and then while the questions are being queued, I thought I'd read out the questions we've had in via email and answer those, so give you all a chance to think about what questions you might ask. So Tammy, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Miles.
Sorry.
And good morning, good afternoon. My name is Tammy from Express Virtual Meetings to conduct your question and answer session. So guests are invited to ask questions by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad now. So what happens is you will be placed in a queue. Listen for your name and I will introduce you through to the call. So just remember, star 1 on your telephone keypad. I think Miles is going to read out some questions, but in the meantime, if you do want to ask it, we do have questions, Miles. Would you like to ask the questions that you have there first?
Exactly. So how about we do that, and we'll see if some of those, we touch on some of the questions people might have already. So look, most of all the questions we've had in about dividends, and I probably should put a slide in that in the presentation. So what I thought I might do is paraphrase the various questions we've had in and answer the key questions that we've had in turn. And just to run through where we are with dividends, we increased our first half dividend this year, the interim dividend with the interim results, from 3 cents to 3.15 cents. But we did have to reduce the franking credits attached to that dividend from 100% down to 50%. The board guided with our first half result that it expects our full year dividend to be at least the same size as the half year dividend. So another 3.15 cents, 50% franked. And including dividend, you know, including franking credits, that dividend payout rate puts us currently on a grossed up yield of just under 7%. So that's where we currently are with dividends. In terms of the outlook for dividends, which is what some of the questions were about, I can't provide any more guidance than what the board has formally done at this stage. But to answer some of the questions that have come in as best I can, I think it's reasonable to say that given the year we're having, the board is going to find itself in a strong position when it does sit down and meets next and has to think about being able to meet or even exceed its half-year guidance for the full year. And depending on how the year finishes, again, I think it seems sensible the board would find itself in a stronger position than it was 6 months ago when it thinks about maintaining or potentially even lifting our current dividend payments into next year. I just have to caveat that with the point that the board is tasked with thinking about the medium to long term for the company and with thinking about what a long-term sustainable dividend payout rate for the company could be. And that leads me to one of the other questions we've had come in, which was how many years of reserve do we have at the current dividend payout rate? I can say at the half year, when the board declared the interim dividend and gave guidance for the full year dividend, we had about 1 year of reserve ahead of us. And to be honest, that's not a terribly large buffer, and it's just a function of us being a young company. It's hard to pay out the high dividend payout that we have and build a reserve at the same time in just a few years. This is my view. You know, it would be nice to see us continue to build that reserve up a bit over time, get the buffer a little bit larger, and I think it's fair to say that'll be also one of the factors, along with our good performance this year, that the board will have to factor into its thinking. And lastly on dividends, we have had a question on when our dividends would be fully franked again. Before I answer this, I'll just remind everyone that as international investors, we do not pick up franking credits on the dividend income that we receive from our overseas investments. We only generate franking credits by successfully making investments and then paying capital gains tax on the profit in Australia. So compared to a fund that only invests in the Australian share market, we sort of have one hand tied behind the back. We miss out on one of the two important sources of franking income. We had to cut the franking credits attached to our dividends earlier this year as we were unable to sustain them at the current dividend payout rate that we were paying. The board took the view that it would be better to keep the current dividend payout rate, and in fact we actually increased it, rather than cut our dividends just to ensure they were fully franked. And the feedback that we've had in, certainly the feedback I've had in, was that's certainly what the majority of shareholders have preferred us to do. After our IPO, we did guide investors to expect us to pay a fully franked dividend in the order of 5% or 5 cents a share. And while it is a little disappointing to cut our franking now from 100 to 50%, we are paying out 6.3%. So grossed up with a much higher dividend, actual dividend number and the lower franking on a grossed up basis, it's certainly true to show shareholders are still much better off. In cutting the franking payout level, which comes back to the question that was asked, we were just bringing the franking credit payments out to a level that we think is sustainable. The board's hope, my hope, is that we can continue to build the franking credit balance back up over time and then increase our franking credits back towards 100% in the next few years. And that will be a function mainly of portfolio success. Tammy, those were all the questions that I'd had emailed in. So if there were some questions on the line, maybe we could take those now.
Yes, there is. Our first question is from Peter. Peter, please go ahead.
Good morning, Miles. It's Peter from Perth, Western Australia here.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you for the presentation. Very good. And congratulations on the new arrival and the family.
Thank you.
Miles, on slide 8, you've chosen not to label the horizontal bar. Am I missing anything there, or did you do that on purpose, or what? What's the situation?
Well, there was probably two factors. One, so this shows every single investment we've made since IPO. So there would be 50 or 60. So very hard to squish all those names into a chart on its side. And then secondly, we do have a flexible mandate, and I guess we have always asked our shareholders for some trust. And the reason for that is there's a number of situations that we invest into that we don't really like to advertise. There's one that we've just exited, and since IPO, so in just under 3 years, we've invested into it and exited out of it 3 times. And each one of those 3 times would be one of the more significant bars you can see on the left-hand side of the chart.
Yeah.
It's a trade that we take advantage of a corporate action. We don't want to share that with anyone. We're happy to share it with our investors. We don't want to share it with our competitors. So that's mainly those are the two reasons. I'm happy to chat about some of them offline if you want, of those particular names that you had some interest in.
I understand your thinking, and thank you very much for the explanation. Good.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your question, Peter. Our next question is from Ralph Greenan. Please go ahead, Ralph.
Thank you. How are you, Miles?
Hi, Ralph. I'm good. How are you, mate?
Yep. Well, congratulations again to you
Thank
and
you.
Your the arrival of Blake. I hope
Thank
him
you.
And Blake are both doing well.
Thank you.
Now, if I could ask you two questions,
yeah.
That'd be good. Now, I remember some time ago, we took a position in the AMP China Fund, which I believe was going to be subsequently wound up.
Yeah.
I was wondering how the final wash-up turned out.
So Ralph, that has been one of our most successful investments. It's certainly, if people have the slide 8 beside them, it's one of the better charts on the left, not the very far left one, but in that in that nice bulge. We engage with AMP, as many of you know, for a period of time behind the scenes and then publicly. In my view, as the lawyers always make the caveat, in my view, they weren't pulling their socks up when it came to corporate governance. And along with a number of other shareholders, we came to a negotiated outcome, which was that they would wind the fund up. And that has largely happened now, Ralph. So they've paid out, I think, 95% of all the money. It's all come out of NAV. So we bought in at 75 cents in the dollar. We exited almost all of our position at 95 cents, a dollar, and there's 5% left to go. And the last little bit is a piece of cash that is slowly being distributed, and we expect the last of it this year. So it's worked out tremendously well for us. I haven't talked about it recently, probably to my mistake, but it has worked out very well for us.
I knew it was being wound up, but they talked about it, perhaps taking 13 months or something, but I think it happened more quickly than that.
Yes, it did, and we've had the bulk of the money out. So there's a little residual that's just cash that we're sitting in a bank account waiting to come.
Now, my other question is just related to sort of the investor presentation.
Yeah.
You've shown gross returns. Now, I was wondering if it's possible to sort of prepare a graph, I don't mean right now, but in future, actually showing what the net return is, because when it's all boiled down, that's the stuff that we want to know.
100%. No, and we have included that. I might have glossed over it. So if we move to slide 11, and we've also included, because, I mean, there's also the net return, which you're exactly right about, Ralph, but probably, I mean, fairly for everyone on this call, but the most important return is the share price return, which is a function of our net return, and then hopefully our ability, the board's ability to keep the share price in line with the NAV of the company. So on
slide 11 is
net returns year to date. And then I think on slide 9, those are net returns since IPO. So those by net returns, we show the portfolio returns after all the manager fees, before tax, before company costs, so these before the small costs that we have for running the company, but those are after manager fee returns. And on slide 11, you can see the dashed line, that's the share price total return, including the dividends and the franking credits that we paid out, which are a real cash benefit to our shareholders.
Very good.
But it is a good point, I have in the past, not intentionally, but I guess when I try and talk about our investment returns, I think about what the team and I have done, and we're thinking little investors that sit in the room and focus on numbers all day, but obviously the after fee numbers are the most important ones, and really the share price return is absolutely the most important one. So the reason for putting in share price return is that's going to be a bit more of a focus of these presentations going forward.
Thank you very much, Miles.
Good on you, Ralph. Tammy?
Yes, we have no further questions. If anybody did want to ask a question, star one on your telephone keypad now. Miles, we don't have any further questions.
Right.
Oh, yes, we do. They're coming through, Miles. Just one moment.
Okay.
I just have to check names out. It won't be a moment.
No problem.
Thank you for holding, Miles. I just had to check names. I do have Nigel who would like to ask a question. Please go ahead, Nigel.
Hi, Miles. Nigel Orfrey.
Hi, Nigel.
Hi. Could you please comment on a couple of the sort of political issues that are going on? So specifically, your view on the US market and tax reform with the Trump administration.
Yeah.
What you think's priced in, your best guess at how that might play out. And secondly, the current UK election and being on the ground there, perhaps you'd give us some color in terms of how that one's playing out as well, please.
Yeah,
thank
sure.
You.
No. Yes, no, of course. Yeah. Thanks, Nigel. So I didn't delve into this too much, but as I alluded, we've had this tremendous rally in share markets driven primarily by Donald Trump turning up to the White House and what the share markets are trying to price in every day. And I don't know if I have any greater insight into what the right level of pricing is, but what the market is trying to price in every day is that, you know, the U.S. recovery, the U.S. were the first country, major country, to grab the bull by the horns. They basically invented the quantitative easing playbooks. They reformed the banks very aggressively. They took a lot of pain very early on, pain that big economies like Europe and the U.K. Have deferred and are still struggling. And the recovery in the U.S. now is really well established. So unemployment is sub 5%. There's lots of good indicators showing that the U.S. is starting to really hum along well. So you've got a U.S. recovery that's performing really well. What Trump has done is added a new layer to the sort of the bull market there, and that is there's this great potential for reform in the U.S. The U.S. tax code is one of the worst in the world. I think it, you know, like five times as long as the Bible. I forget the exact statistics. And you have the situation where U.S. tax rates are enormously high at a headline rate, but there's an avalanche of deductions, so no one pays the headline rate. And it's this absolute basket case of a city tax system where everything falls to the bottom, and no tax is actually collected, and it creates huge burdens. And you also have these rules that Congress put in place a long time ago to keep, to try and protect U.S. investment in the U.S., which is basically meant that a lot of U.S. Firms have decided to stash huge piles of cash offshore. So, and the problem we've had in the U.S. is that we've spent the last 10 years, the only piece of legislative initiative has been healthcare reform, which is, you know, probably a really good thing. I'm not saying it's not, but it occupied government for 10 years. And then before that, we had 10 years of Bush and basically a war president. So really, the U.S. is 20 years overdue in terms of reforming all this stuff. So what the market is pricing in with someone like Trump, you have this big shock result. Trump's come in. What the market's pricing in less who Trump is and rather the fact that you have I realize the irony in what I'm going to say, a coherent government in charge. And by coherent, I don't mean the Twitter in chief, but rather the fact that one party has control over all three branches, so finally there's the prospect of something going through. So I think there's a huge amount of low-hanging fruit. The market's seen that and priced it in. From here, and I'm sorry, Nigel, I don't have any greater insight into the crystal ball, but you know, my understanding, my thinking would be from here, it's really going to be about delivering. So the markets have rallied strongly on the surprise and the potential that coherent government could bring. From here, it's really going to be, I think, show me the money, so show us the reforms actually coming through. And, you know, today there's been a lot of gridlock, even though it's still the same one party. But I think the key message to say, and you know, the reasons why, you know, I see a lot of people, you know, probably want to. The bigger mistakes I made this year was I was very cautious straight after Trump, like a lot of people. I put the portfolio in a very cautious position. You know, we don't aim to take market views, but we have hedging tools and we have the ability to try and reduce our risk at times when I feel that maybe it's not worth it. And in hindsight, but that position was wrong. Markets have rallied very strongly. My takeaway is that there's no reason they can't continue to rally, which is probably it's controversial. If the reforms come through, if we can see Trump push through some reform, there is actually a lot of low-hanging fruit. But I think where the market is today, and I wouldn't want to bet it's right or wrong, it's pricing in, you know, the risks that there's a lot of bluff, a lot of blunder, and nothing actually happens. And at the same time, trying to price in some probability that there is some reform that comes in. In the UK, I do sit here on the ground. I wrote to you all after Brexit. I was very forlorn. In my view, terrible mistake. But I think, you know, I would probably be a good case study. So like a lot of people that I know in the city, professional services, we voted to remain and thought that was a sensible thing to do. But we all live in a democracy and, you know, the vote was that we should leave. And I think, especially over the last few months, there's certainly been a realisation that this is what's going to happen and now we have to make the best of it. And I think that is underpinning what's happening in the election. So the Conservative Party, which was for a long time viewed as the nasty party, has suddenly raced ahead in the polls, and that is because, you know, whether you're left-wing or right-wing, Labour or Liberal, the only issue that's important right now is do you want someone that's competent to be negotiating with Brussels to try and get a sensible resolution for everyone? There's so much to play for here, and there's so many ways that we, you know, the UK can still stay involved with the rest of Europe. The UK has a trading deficit with Europe, so the UK buys more stuff from Europe than Europe sells to it. So it's certainly in Europe's interest to try and put a sensible proposal together in all sorts of areas. We just had the Manchester bombing here, which is terrible, and highlights how important it is for security cooperation, along with all these other things that, you know, union and inverted commas bring. So the stark choice is, do you want to vote in Corbyn, who is, you know, I don't want to offend anyone, but, you know, has a pedigree of poor leadership and possibly poor judgment, especially when it comes to really important issues like national security, or someone like Theresa May, who I think the electorate's really taken to as competent, not showy, and someone that is imminently more qualified to negotiate a deal with Brussels. So in terms of what's happening here in the UK, it's really going to be a question of by how much the Conservatives win. And there'll be a huge turnaround from, you know, certainly the 10, 15 years I've been in London, where they were sort of the unelectable party. And that's really just an issue of competence. The big economic challenges or discussions that come up in an election are really in the background. The only thing that people are focused on is someone competent managing the renegotiation with Brussels. I've rabbited on a bit there, Nigel, but I hope that helps.
Thanks, Miles.
Thank you so much, Nigel, for your question. Miles, our next question is from Michael Kent. Michael, please go ahead.
G'day, Miles.
Hi, Michael.
Yeah, keep up the good work. It's the performance is great.
Thank you.
Just wanted to ask, on that chart on page 13 you've got, you talked about your cash levels being perhaps a bit higher of late. Does that reflect anything? That was my kind of first question. And the second question, I'd be interested in how you're viewing Europe at the moment. I mean, there's been quite a rally in quite a few markets in Europe. And do you think with the sort of extension of what you're saying about the UK, that can continue?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So 113, I sort of tripped over my words as I was running through the slide, unfortunately, but I did want to say, so the cash levels have ticked up recently. A little bit of that, but by no means the majority, is we've just done the placement. So there's a lot more cash in the portfolio. We invested that and we had a big harvest period. But by far the most important thing, and something I probably should have touched on a bit more detail, with one of our biggest investments at the moment, I think it's about 7% of NAV, is a special situation we found here in the UK. It's a complicated story, but we effectively own cash. So we bought into a portfolio of cash as a private equity vehicle that was bid for by another private equity vehicle. I won't bore everyone with the machinations, but to get favourable tax treatment, there was a complicated way that the one private equity vehicle bid for the other private equity vehicle. And when the takeover was completed, the private equity vehicle that was left was just a portfolio of cash with a schedule for repaying that cash. And we play around in these closing funds, and as you all know, the investors in these vehicles are not always perfectly rational. So we were able to build up a position at a really attractive IRR for a portfolio of cash that is liquidating over the current year. So about 7% of the NAV at the moment is cash that we bought at a discount, which we'll be getting back in a couple of months' time. On Europe, you know, there's sort of two things that are going on, and I'll leave the second one, which is the tail risk and a bit scary and probably won't come to the fore, but probably not definitely. We are definitely going through a European comeback story. So the US, the recovery is well established. In the last 6 months, and especially in more recent months, all the economic data has showed that Europe is finally starting to look like it's getting a bit of its mojo. In Germany, you know, always the driving force for the European economy, it's looking very much like the US. So unemployment rates are getting down towards 4%. You know, it's finding workers is the biggest problem at the moment. Industrial production just puts on strength after strength, month after month. But more importantly, some of the other big sluggish economies like France and Spain and almost even Italy are starting to catch up. And at a economy-wide level, a lot of the comments that have been coming out of the ECB and what, you know, the currency markets have picked up on why the euro's rallied recently, is that we're finally starting to see some inflation coming through the system. And then, you know, the central bank narrative, so in Australia, the central bank narrative at the moment is we're sort of on hold, maybe there's a chance for a cut. In Europe, the central bank narrative is now, when do we take away these extraordinary measures? Not, you know, they're going to be there for as long as needed, but rather there's open discussions in the press and with central bank members about tapering, reducing the size of the ECB balance sheet, and in the last few meetings, Draghi talked about when interest rates might rise. So finally, there's some good evidence that Europe's finally starting to catch up to the US after a long period of time. That's been what's driving especially the European currency and European share markets. I will just add in the tail risk, and this is probably something for you all to reflect on, not to worry about too much, but I think I was out there last time, I talked about the three big tests coming up for Europe. You had the Dutch elections, you had the Italian referendum, and then obviously the French election. And they've all, you know, the Italian referendum didn't go the right way, and that's what I'll touch on. The other two elections did, and the sort of European existential risk has fallen off the front page of the newspaper. I would highlight that it hadn't really gone away. And the problem with Europe as a structure is that, you know, we sort of live this sigh of relief, oh, the Dutch referendum goes the right way, or oh, the French election goes the right way, but we automatically just continually roll from one potential risk to the next potential risk, with any of these risks having the ability to unwind the whole project. And I highlight these as tail risks, so wouldn't get too worried about them. They're worth paying attention to. In my view, you know, and a lot of, you know, pure economists view, the architecture of the EU has never really been properly put together. It's not a country like the United States or like Australia. In Australia, you'd never think twice about New South Wales tax revenues ending up in Queensland, or Melbourne tax dollars ending up in Northern Territory. You never think twice about joining an army in Western Australia to go and fight alongside someone in Sydney. That's certainly not the case in Europe. You don't have this shared history of collaboration. You have a very different sort of history in terms of, you know, not collaborating. And the problem, you know, so there's this architectural problem that's never really been solved. And the next big test is in Italy. The referendum was lost last year. The Prime Minister resigned, and a caretaker Prime Minister has come in. The Prime Minister that has resigned is working his way back to become head of the party, and is hopefully going to contest elections. And there are another set of elections that has to take place in 12 months' time. The cold shower for everyone to pay attention to is that the party ahead in the polls is this five-star party run by a comedian and sort of famous blogger, very left-wing, very incoherent kind of policies, who is vehemently anti-EU and anti-the euro. And he's promised that if he gets into power, he's going to hold a referendum on whether or not Italy should stay a member of the eurozone currency. And Italy is really the really scary case for policymakers. So debt to GDP is over 130%. I don't think they've balanced the budget inside of a century. Unemployment, youth unemployment, towards 30%. Regular unemployment, well into the high double digits. I think Zimbabwe's had better economic growth than Italy over the last 10 years. So it's a really sad case, and certainly a place with a lot of risk for big external shock. The five-star party is polling in the mid-30s, so it's not a case that they're obviously going to get a majority, but the more worrying factor is something close to 50% of the Italian electorate is at this point in time supportive of what you call radical or fringe policies. So 35% of the five-star party, another 15% spread a bunch of other, rather eclectic, uneducated, certainly not economic people. And that is going to be the next risk for Europe that we have to sort of muddle our way through next year.
Thanks, Miles. Italy's still a great place to go and holiday.
Definitely. Wonderful place to go. That's kind of good.
Thank you so much, Michael. Our next question is from Edward Patching. Please go ahead, Edward.
Thank you very much. And hi, Miles, from Edward Patching in chilly Canberra. -3 here, and we were greatly disappointed. Many were the disappointed faces when you didn't show up last week with the Jeff Wilson team on a briefing. So we look forward to you coming back. Miles, I might need to offer another apology in advance, because I was only able to join today's presentation 3 questions ago with the questioner who asked about could we see a graph on net return. And I'd just like to firstly both praise the return that the fund is generating, and for your efforts in that regard. Don't apologise for the machinations. We love all your machinations and the return it's producing. But we're less impressed with the machinations around reporting, because I don't want to be too rude about this. It's too clever.
Oh, too rude.
It,
okay.
It, it's just a bit too sophisticated, and it doesn't tell us the sort of things that at least a percentage of your retail shareholders would like to see. For instance, a graph on a Sharpe ratio is there, but there's no graph on the share price. And a Sharpe ratio won't have a lot of meaning to at least a percentage of your audience, and the others amongst will know that it's possible to game it. So a share price, on the other hand, will tell us that over the last 6 months, the share price has had a 10% decline, not a 10%, it's $1.16, whatever, now $1.10, a 6% decline, but it's about the third longest period, or one third of the period when the shares were in decline between early 15 and, towards the mid of 2016. Mm. So I wonder if you haven't already commented earlier in your presentation about what you think the share price might have declined for. And to return to the question of the net return, I still think this could be made much simpler and much better. Your two performance graphs run happily from the bottom left to the top right, but your shareholders aren't seeing the share price do that. And when we see that your version of net return still includes company expenses and taxes, frankly, we're not yet at the kind of return point that your shareholders obviously get, and it would be nice if they could be corrected, please.
Edward, those are tremendous questions. So let me talk about some of those if I can. If you do have the presentation and you flip to slide 11, and you might have missed me hitting this in the presentation and talking about it. So we have taken those points on board, and what we've put in slide 11 is the share price total return year to date. So total return obviously includes dividends, and I've put into it franking credits, and that comes to one of the things you said in terms of before tax returns. So GVF is a onshore Australian vehicle, and it's been set up primarily to provide a opportunity to invest in the investment strategy we do, and to pay out a high income rate to all of its investors. So we pay out basically everything that we take in. We pay tax along the way, and as we pay out dividends, we return the tax credits that we've generated through franking credit. So when we pay a dividend with franking credits attached, it is just as valuable as paying out a higher dividend. If you don't, we're basically paying some tax to our shareholders, and if you're not a tax-paying person, then you literally go to the ATO and they'll give you a check to return that cash. So the way I think about it, the value that we return to our shareholders. And on slide 11, you can see the share price total return, which you're absolutely right, the only important thing really for shareholders. There's a slight difference between how we've talked about net returns this time and in the past, and that was a discussion with the board on how we should present our manager returns, the board's decision was we should talk about net returns after manager fees, and then the company costs is something that the board decides, and the company costs are quite de minimis. In terms of recent share price performance, it has been a bit soft. I would counter that by saying, the biggest reason why the share price has been soft lately is we've just paid a big fat dividend, so 3.15 cents with 50% franking credits. That has just under 4 cents of value in our shareholders' hands. As a fund, as soon as we pay a 3.15 cent dividend, it'd be normal to expect the share price to fall by 3.15 cents, probably a little bit more because of the franking credit value. In terms of our year-to-date, we've had a very good year in terms of alpha. We've had one meaningful down month, that was in January. So we had a really good return 6 months of last year. We had a down month in January. We still generated alpha, but we lost some money because of the Australian dollar rally. And then February onwards, we've been slowly regaining those losses, and we're back past the high point for the year. But I think in terms of the recent period, the share price softness would be a factor of the dividend we paid out. We also did a capital raising, which does impact the share price a little bit for a little while. But I don't think that's really had a huge impact on where we've been. But Edward, you talked about this before. We recently brought in some help on the investor relations side. So I would be delighted to take on board some of the suggestions you've made. We get guys emailing us all the time. And the reason we're putting in a share price chart is because someone like you suggested that was correctly, the most important thing to put in these presentations. Yeah, I hope that helps. I'm not sure
where I'm standing up there. Thanks, Miles. That does help, and it is useful, and I'd be, when at another convenient time, have a bit of a chat about that. I mean, I still see that footnote 2 on slide 11 says that the investment returns are measured before company expenses and tax. So that looks to my casual read that there's something else yet to come out of that. And
So what I mean by before tax is, so we manage the portfolio, and as the investment team, we're given a notional dollar, and we go and invest that as best we can. When we say before tax, what I'm saying is the company pays tax, and then it returns that to shareholders via franking credit. So maybe I can explain this, put that a little bit better. But it does, you know, in investment return speak, if we pay tax and then pay it back out, it's just like paying a dividend. If we pay tax and then pay it back to shareholders through a franking credit, it's another part of the returns.
If you are here counting in the franking returns, which I understand you are, then it would seem that the parallel should be that you should also count in the company tax, because it looks like you're only, and for those of us who are in the shareholders in super funds, it's a legitimate inclusion, although it's not, it's a sort of an incidental return rather than a return through clever fund management. It's more an advantage of the Australian tax system. But I agree it's a legitimate inclusion, but it should also be balanced by the expense component. So it seems odd that you'd count the franking credit and not count the company, the tax component.
Two sides to the same coin. So the dashed line includes the franking credit. The blue line, our net return. So why we've included tax, I just got it in my head a little bit clearer now. So, you know, we make a return, hopefully a successful investment, we make a return on it, we pay tax. So what I'm saying, I don't think it's remotely fair for our investment returns to be penalised by a 30% tax rate. If we make a dollar, if we generated 100% of returns, it's not reasonable to say that our investment returns have only been 70%. We've generated 100% of returns. We've had to pay 30% of tax on that, and I'm showing the returns before the 30% of tax. The reason I'm doing that is the 30% of tax is going to get paid out the next year in the dashed line. So what I'm trying to show is what we as other, the two things I'm trying to show, share price total return, so what the value has ended up in your hands, and then what we have done as an investment manager after fees. So what we have done as an investment manager, invest a portfolio of shareholders' capital. We've made a return on that, and that's the return I'm talking about. I make the return after fees. So I talk about all the costs, all the returns after the manager costs. But I'm saying it's before tax, because it's not remotely right to say that our investment return over the year was 70% when we've actually made 100% investing shareholder capital. But that's the principle I'm trying to convey. I appreciate maybe I haven't done it as well as I could.
Thanks, Miles. I look forward to another chat. I'm sure we'll find a few more points in there that we can enjoy discussing.
Thank you so much, Edward. Miles, we have no further questions. However, I have received one from an email, which I will read out to you. Hello, Miles. Hi. In percentage terms, what is rough country spread of GVF portfolio, and how wide a net do you cast?
Sure. So that is reflecting on Edward's comments just now. I'm trying to keep it simple and not too complicated. Just to highlight some of the things. So we invest into, generally invest into listed funds or fund type structures, somewhere we can buy a portfolio of assets at a discount. And generally where we're investing into, these instruments are listed on big developed market exchanges, generally in London or New York. That doesn't necessarily reflect where the underlying assets that we bought are. So it's very easy for us to go and buy a fund or an investment trust in the UK that owns a portfolio of Australian bonds. And the way why we put all this time into sort of showing look-through exposure and aggregating exposure sets is to try and convey that while we're buying a trust that's domiciled in the UK, so it's called a UK company that owns a portfolio of Australian assets. What I can say is that, you know, in simpler speech, the vast majority of the assets that we own are in developed markets like the US, Europe, Australia, Canada, North, South Korea. We have some exposure to emerging markets. We have a reasonable weighting in Vietnam at the moment, just because we found some very exciting opportunities that are very cheap and where we've made some really good returns, but they are quite small. You know, that would be less than 10% of the portfolio. So the vast majority of our assets are in big developed countries. They're spread across equities, bonds, other types of assets like real estate investment trusts, cash, as I was saying before, you know, big exposure to cash sitting in an HSBC bank account here in the UK at the moment. But without getting too technical, I think I'll leave it there, Tony. So the majority of our, by far the vast majority of our portfolio is invested into developed markets.
Thank you so much for that question, Miles. We don't have any further questions at the moment.
Okay. Guys, look, thank you everyone for making time for this call. If you did have a minute at the end, you know, good, bad or indifferent, Edward, I always love your comments. We do take them on. So if there's anything you think we could be doing better in the presentations, or whether you thought this was a good medium to, you know, make myself available, it's certainly a much more efficient medium in terms of time than the month it takes to send on the road. Any feedback would be very much appreciated. I will be there in November for the AGM, and I'll be seeing all the cities that I normally do, and I hope to have a chance to see you all in person then. Thank you very much.